You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Oh, Hebrews, what are we going to do with you? Probably more responsible than any other biblical source for the development and promotion of that most unhelpful of traditional Christian ideas, substitutionary atonement. But there it is, skulking around in the middle of the New Testament, not missing a single opportunity to sow confusion and division, and doing so in one of the most disingenuous ways possible, misrepresenting its own author. Whoever the anonymous author was, at least they were smart. They knew that writing the letter in the voice of Paul would lend some extra authority. And despite not agreeing with a lot of the content, I have to admit that whoever the author was could really grab the reader's attention. It is full of dire warnings and extravagant promises. The various extremes are punctuated by the writer's almost frenetic pleas for the people to press on in faithfulness so that they may bring the promises of salvation to fruition in their own lives. They could also really turn a phrase. In fact, in chapter 12, the metaphor the author establishes has become an idiom used across the Western world, a cloud of witnesses. It's a great image, this cloud of witnesses, and while like most of Hebrews, it's not to be taken literally, still, it paints a relatable picture for those of us sharing this journey of life together.
Our words of wisdom today are from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2a. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Southern Baptist preacher Carlisle Marney used to say that your personhood, your personality, persona is like a house. And it's a fairly elaborate and complex structure. Some are fancy, some are sophisticated, some are simple and functional. Some are ostentatious, and some are modest. Each has a number of rooms, a formal parlor for greeting guests, a family room, bedroom, kitchen. Marnie said each of us has in the structure of our persona a basement where the plumbing is located and the trash is stored. No need to spend your life down there, Marnie used to say. Everybody has a basement. Come on up into the sunshine. Sometimes we act as if the plumbing and trash bin are all there is to us, Marnie observed. And if you come upstairs and step outside onto the front lawn and look up, you will see that the house that is you has a spacious, gracious balcony. And there are people up there on your balcony. Marnie was a Southerner, so his balcony was white wrought iron with wicker rocking chairs. There are people in the rocking chairs on your balcony. And depending on whether you're a Baptist or a Presbyterian, they're sipping iced tea or bourbon. The people on your balcony are the strong, positive influences in your life, your heroes and heroines, your models and mentors. Your parents may be up there, your grandparents. There's some folk up there you never met, but they influenced and helped shape you. And there are some really big names up there, people whose lives inspired you from afar and called deeper faith out of you and courage and stamina and love and discipline. Simply put, the people on your balcony are your saints. And a good way for you to observe All Saints Day might be to walk out onto your lawn, look up, and don't just wave to them, name them. Call the roll. These are your saints, your dear ones, the great ones and small ones. Maybe your mother or your father, maybe your old coach, your piano teacher, Oscar Romero, Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King Jr. You might say, okay, I get it. I get Dorothy Day and MLK being saints, but your coach and your piano instructor, your grandmother, Sunday school teacher? You bet. Surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses is the writer's way of glancing over the shoulder one last time at the list of people of faith that were in the background, or as Marnie put it, looking to the balcony. Starting in chapter 11, Hebrews lists a whole litany of saints, beginning with Adam and Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham and Sarah, Jacob, Isaac, Moses, Rahab, on and on the list goes. Considering the rest of Hebrews, I'm surprised at the writer's restraint in not preaching a little sermon after each one of the names, adding a little exhortation after every name. Shouldn't we all be strong like Samson? Shouldn't we all be willing to give up everything like Abraham, or be as brave as Rahab? Yada, yada, yada. Now, the author of Hebrews just makes a list of biblical characters who, if you know anything about their stories, are normal people with struggles, shortcomings, and challenges we all can relate to. All that the writer does with these great people of faith is to say they lived their lives and trusted in God. They endured and they were faithful. And that's all that any of us are expected to do, to live our lives with integrity of spirit and endure whatever comes our way in a manner that reflects the values we've embraced as followers of Jesus. But still, it's tempting to line up illustrations of the accomplishments of the likes of Albert Schweitzer or Mother Teresa, of the missionaries who had their feet frozen off in the tundras of the north. And I think the author of Hebrews knew that that might be depressing. It could intimidate people to tick off all the great accomplishments of the superheroes of faith. And that's why, almost with a toss of the hand, all those great biblical characters are almost dismissed as a group and clumped together in a cloud of witnesses. The author then turns the spotlight on the reader, on you and me, and says, it's your time now. It's your turn to take all of this that has gone before and take it one step further. I'm just glad the author of Hebrews didn't know the motto of the French Foreign Legion. If I falter, push me on. If I stumble, pick me up. If I retreat, shoot me. That's certainly one way of living in community. But for us, as a community of faith with a cloud of witnesses looking on, it means we don't have to go it alone. We don't have to do it ourselves. We can look to each other for accountability, encouragement, and support. We are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses who have gone before, and we are surrounded by a gathering of fellow followers of Jesus who support us, who spur us on, and who encourage us to be more loving, more compassionate, and more like Jesus. The last 9 months or so has really thrown a wrench in our comfortable and dependable habits. Back in the before time, before the pandemic, some of us would come to church because it was our feel-good fix for the week. Maybe we came out of a sense of obligation. Maybe it was the place where you could be reminded of God's unconditional love, where you could participate in the sacraments and experience the comfort of a community that not only offers love and support, but direction and purpose for our lives. but we've all had to adapt to a new reality. And it's calling each of us to be who we are in new ways and do what we do best in ways we haven't thought of before. Maybe you can relate to the narrator in Anne Lamott's book, All New People, when she tells about going to her church one Sunday morning. Like Lamott, the narrator is a white member of a predominantly African-American church. She says, there was a part of every service right after we sang the doxology where the choir sang a selection, but on this particular Sunday, old Fred's daughter, Esther, was going to sing alone, a cappella. She was black as a person could be, shy, heavy, cherubic, 25 or so. She stood by the piano, closed her eyes, inhaled deeply, and sang the first crystalline notes of Awake My Soul. But then she missed the next note, and then the next. She was singing them both too high, and in the succeeding notes, she tried to compensate, but instead, she completely lost the melody. I mean, honey, it was excruciating. Esther had her eyes closed, her fists clenched, standing in front of us all, warbling away, way off key and out of tune, and tears began splashing down her face, and poor old Esther, with the clearest, sweetest voice on earth, wavered away and came to the end of the first verse. The pastor said softly, "Relax, relax." And Esther clenched her fists even tighter and started in on the second verse. And all the white people in church were in a wild, frantic form of catatonia. You could have scrambled radar with our discombobulation. But then, the women in the first row of chairs nearest Esther, the women who usually sang in the tiny choir, began to whisper the melody, humming it. You could barely hear them. And Esther's hands were still in fists, and her face was full of humiliation, but she could hear the melody. And she sang it over the softest possible singing of the four black women. And I swear it was like when a whale is weak or bleeding, and the other whales in the school swim underneath it and buoy it up to the air so it can breathe. I think to one degree or another, everybody I know feels a little bit like Esther these days. Eyes closed, fists clenched, tears splashing down our faces, and still not able to find that old familiar melody. The pastor can say, "Relax, relax," as much as he wants, but when it comes right down to it, what really gets any of us through is that hum we sense rising up from our cloud of witnesses, both past and present. We buoy one another up with a quietness and strength that isn't splashy or flamboyant, but just right. None of us should feel discouraged because our part doesn't seem very big. Because whatever part we play is a unique and unrepeatable gift. Because each of us is a unique and unrepeatable gift. The great saints have understood this. We each have a part and we're in it together. That's why our stream of thought today is a reminder to Esther and to all of us. There's no such thing as a cappella. None of us truly sings alone. One of the saints occupying a big corner of my balcony is Harold Beck. He used to tell a story about being in Springfield, Illinois for a lecture and going for a walk early one morning. He said, "I was walking by Mr. Lincoln's home at 6:45, and a woman from the National Park Service said, 'Would you like to come in?' So," Harold said, "I looked around Mr. Lincoln's house, and when I walked outside, noticed that all the sidewalks were torn up. The National Park Service had an absolutely marvelous sign all around where you had to jump across a pit or a gravel pile. It said, "Sorry for the inconvenience, but we are tearing up the present so you may enjoy the past." How about that? Harold said he wanted to write across the bottom of one of the signs, "So that you can have a future." Somebody in the National Park Service is really biblical. Whoever we are, and whatever our gifts or accomplishments are, we are in debt to mentors, saints, and those who have invested in their present so that we can have a future. They dreamed and sacrificed as an expression of their faith. We, in turn, are called to dream, sacrifice, and invest in the present so that others can have a future. We each have our part to sing, and it is integral to the whole. No one else, great or small, can sing our part for us. I am grateful for the gifts of those who have shared their lives with me and the influence their witness has had on my life. Their memory has become a part of me and continues to inspire and strengthen me. So I hope you'll join me in not only taking some time to call the roll of your cloud of witnesses, but to consider what you can do to rise to the challenge of taking your place in the cloud of witnesses, investing in the present so that others can have a future. Because there's no such thing as a cappella. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information, or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.